Good afternoon. I'd like to call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, April 25th, 2018. The time is 1:35 p.m. If you're joining us off net or online, we're in Juneau, Alaska, the Capitol, in the State Capitol building. We're on the fifth floor, room 532. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. With me this afternoon, Co-Chairman Hoffman.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Vice Chairman Bishop.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Good morning,
Senator Machicki.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
We are a full complement. On today's agenda, we have two items, SB 142, the appropriation bill for the capital budget, and HB 316, restrict access to marijuana crimes records. Is there anything to come before the committee before we begin? Seeing and hearing none, the first item on today's agenda is SB 142. I'd like to invite Laura Kramer, my chief of staff, to the microphone. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the committee substitute for Senate Bill 142 Finance 30-Golf Sierra 2565 / Oscar before the committee as our working document.
I'll object for purposes of understanding. Brief at ease while we pass out the documents. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. We have the capital budget before us. It's SB 142, version O. Ms. Kramer, if you could identify yourself for the record and then walk us through the highlights.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Laura Kramer, and I am staff to Senator McKinnon and the Senate Finance Committee. I will do a walkthrough section by section, highlighting the changes or differences between what the governor proposed to us and what is in the bill before you. I will also point out that the governor had submitted two different capital type bills. One is your traditional capital budget and then also a contingency capital budget that was contingent on the passage of some form of revenue. The bill before you does incorporate some items that were in that contingency bill that truly do belong in the capital budget. And Madam Chair, with a little bit of latitude, I just want to say thank you to the departments and the agencies that worked with myself and Legislative Finance for hours on end, going through past appropriations, going through their current capital requests and other needs, and before you as a work product as a result of those conversations. So starting on section 1, pages 2 through 10, this is the agency capital appropriations proposed by the governor and amended by the Senate Finance Committee in the CS. On line 19 of page 2, this is the bulk fuel upgrades. We're using ADA dividends, replacing UGF $5 million. On page 3, lines 18 through 20, this is a new project. It's a cruise ship tender dock reconstruction for just over $1 million. And this is using the cruise vessel passenger funds, or CVP funds, as we call them. The next project on line, page 3, lines 31 and 32, this is another CVP-funded project for the Ketchikan cruise ship berth dock 4 expansion for $3 million. On page 4, lines 14 through 15, this is Fish and Game. This has to do with the Pittman-Robertson funds that we received from the federal government. There were concerns that the Fish and Game Fund was going to be overspent. And so we've replaced the $4 million with $2 million in fishing, $2 million in statutory designated receipts and $2 million of charter revolving loan funds.
Three for these. We're back on the record. Ms. Kramer.
Madam Chair, just to go back one page to page 4, we did include in the CS $24.2 million in major maintenance funding for the top five projects on the major maintenance list. The next project, page 5, lines 19 through 20. This is a proposal that was put forth by the governor for the existing election voting system and replacing that system and modernizing it. It's for the project is $4.8 million, 3.8 of which is coming from $3 million of federal and $800,000 in reappropriations. There's currently $1 million in the election fund that will go towards this project as well. Page 5, lines 21 through 27. This is $20 million to address deferred maintenance of state agencies, and we included intent language to help direct the Office of Management and Budget and how to direct those funds out to agencies based on priority and need. Page 5, line 28 through page 6, line 21. This was another project that was submitted by the governor, and it's for IT projects in various departments and modernizing and updating those their computer systems. And some of these are also for compliance purposes with for federal requirements. Page 6, lines 25 through 26. We funded the Code Blue Emergency Medical Services match money at the FY18 level of $500,000. Page 6, lines 29 through 30, we funded the Pioneer Home renovations and repair at the FY18 level of $1 million. Page 7, lines 15 through 20, this is projects for EVO's funding, the Exxon Valdez oil spill money, and these are projects that were approved by the Trustee Council and included in this budget. Page 7, lines 30 through 31, we reduced the National Mineral Security Program funding based on anticipated reduced federal funding. So it's funded at $5 million in the CS before you. On page 8, lines 24 through 25, we included funding for AHFC facility deferred maintenance at $3 million in federal funds and $3 million in AHCC funds. And this is an addition to the $3 million of AHFC funds and $1 million in federal funds included in the operating budget for ongoing maintenance. On page 9, lines 4 through 5, we funded the senior citizen housing at the FY18 level of $1 million. Page 9, lines 6 through 7, we funded the Supplemental Housing Development Program at the FY18 level of $3 million. And on page 9, lines 13 through 17, we included intent language for the Department of Transportation to directing them to develop a temporary traffic control plan as well as an emergency traffic control plan for the Glen Highway, specifically from milepost 0 to milepost 35. This is a result in response to the accident that closed the highway for many days and had to reroute traffic as a result. On page 9, lines 26 through 28, we funded the Municipal Harbor Facility Grant program at $5 million, and it totals $5 million. You won't see the full $5 million here because part of it is funded through a reappropriation in Section 22. On page 10, lines 6 through 10, we funded the federal aid highway match at $51 million in UGF and $14 million in reappropriations found in Section 21, so that their total project highway match is $65 million. And then not in this section, but in Section 21 also, you will find the federal aid, aviation, and other non-federal aid highway program match. And then, Madam Chair, items that were removed from this section that people may be wondering where they are or why they're not listed here. We've removed the money or the request for the Port of Anchorage that the governor had put forth. We included in Section 18, but not in the number section because it's funded with a reappropriation, the Correctional Security Upgrade Project. The Fish and Game Vessel and Aircraft Maintenance Repair and Upgrades was also moved to the language section in Section 20, as it's also funded with a reappropriation. We did not include outside legal counsel or financial due diligence money for the AKLNG project for DNR or DOR. Both of those requests were for $750,000. We did not include the Enhanced 911 project that the governor had put forth as an amendment and for just roughly $8.5 million. We removed funding relating to the ADAC airport. That's an operating item and is in the Operating Budget Conference Committee. We removed the public and community transportation state match of $1 million. The community assistance program is fully funded in the operating budget. And communities could prioritize the local match using those funds. And then we did not include the commuter rail concept that the governor had put forth for $4.5 million. That's the summary for the number section. Section 2 on pages 11 through 13, this is the breakout of funding by agency for appropriations made in Section 1. Section 3, pages 14 through 15, is the breakout of statewide funding for appropriations made in Section 1. The total UGF spend in Section 1 of $139,492,862. Section 4 on page 16, these are supplemental capital projects and grants. And starting on page 16, lines 10 through 11, we included the project to move barracks from J-Bear in Anchorage to Matarvik, and this is to help relocate the residents of the village of Newtok. It's $960,000, and it leverages $3,800,000 in federal funds through the Denali Commission. Also on page 16, lines 15 through 17, this is another EVOS project that the legislature funded last year. And after a updated land appraisal, the land appraisal came in $3 million higher than what we had authorized. And so this is an additional $3 million to complete that transaction. Staying on page 16, lines 21 through 26, this is $2.5 million to process and store untested sexual assault kits. And people may wonder why we're continuing to store. The protocol is you continue to store even after they're tested. So they need additional money for storage and then for processing. We also added intent language to help guide the department through this process and utilizing these funds. Turning to page 17, line 5, we included the Clutina Lake Road Survey Project for $350,000. This was a request by the governor. On page 17, lines 9 through 12, we included funding for the University of Alaska to conduct a study on long-acting contraceptions. It's for $500,000, and they are required to provide reports to the legislature as the study is conducted. Section 5, found on page 18, this is funding by agency for appropriations made in Section 4. And Section 6, page 19, this is statewide funding for the appropriations made in Section 4. There's $10,310,000 in UGF. And Section 7, page 20, we included some supplemental operating items proposed by the governor. I will point out that there are still several outstanding supplemental items that have not been resolved or agreed to by both bodies. Section 8, page 21, this is funding by agency for appropriations made in Section 7. And Section 9 is the statewide funding for appropriations made in Section 7. This is a total spend of nearly $3.8 million in UGF. Sections 10 through 19 are primarily the governor's requested supplemental language items. On Section 10, this is the standard language for the Department of Administration for their labor contract negotiations and arbitration support of $792,000. It extends the lapse date through FY19. Section 11, page 23, lines 8 through 12. This is funding for the Mount Edgecombe Aquatic Center for the operations of it, which I understand they're having their grand opening next Friday. Section 12, page 23, lines 19 through 23. This is to the Department of Health and Social Services for $5 million. This is for the Alaska Temporary Assistance Program to satisfy the federal maintenance of effort requirement for FY18 and 19. And Section 13, page 23, lines 24 through 27. This is to the Department of Law for judgments and settlements, just over $3.3 million. Section 14, page 23, line 28 through page 24, line 11. This is fund capitalization of the election fund that I spoke of earlier. Section 15, page 24, lines 12 through 20, this is standard language, no change was made here. And same with section 16 on page 24. Section 17, page 24, line 26 through page 25, line 23, these are the MPRA grants. The total MPRA grants this year are $11,611,722. This is an increase over last year, actually, of $10 million. Section 18, page 26, lines 1 through 5. This is to the Department of Corrections. This is for their security upgrades at correctional facilities that I spoke of earlier for $1.6 million. Section 19, page 26, lines 6 through 22. There's no change in this section from what the governor proposed. Section 20, page 26, line 23 through page 27, line 11. This is for the Department of Fish and Game. This is a reappropriation estimated to be $309,000 for Fish and Game for maintenance of, repair of, and upgrades to vessels and aircraft. Section 21, page 27, lines 12 through 4. This is for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. This is a reappropriation of over $12 million to DOT for federal aid aviation match and other non-federal aid highway program match. Page 27, line 25 through page 33, line 26, these are the various reappropriations to DOT for federal aid highway match. So turning to page 33, line 27 through page 34, line 14. This is an amendment requested by the governor that we included. It's a reappropriation not to exceed $10 million to DOT for the Alaska International Airport System for rehabilitation of runways and taxiways. Section 22 on page 34, lines 15 through 19. This is fund capitalization. This is a reappropriation of $1.97 million to the Muni Harbor grant program that I spoke of earlier. This balance brings the total for the program up to the $5 million, and that will fund one project in Sitka, the Sitka Crescent Harbor. Section 23, page 34, lines 20 through 22. This is also this is a fund transfer. This is for the large vessel gaming and gambling tax. The balance is estimated to be $8.7 million and is appropriated to the Alaska Marine Highway System Fund. Section 24 on page 34, lines 23 through 28. This is a disbursement of fees that are collected from the purchase of NRA license plates, and the amount is estimated to be $6,000. And it is appropriated to the Department of Commerce to be distributed as a grant to the Alaska SCTP Nonprofit Corporation for statewide youth shotgun programs. Section 25 on page 34 through page 35, line 3. This is a reappropriation estimated to be just over $98,000. It's to the city of Kodiak for design and engineering of a new fire hall. And this is due to structural damage as a result of the earthquake in, I believe it was 2017. Section 26, page 35, lines 4 through 20. This is the standard reappropriation language for legislative appropriations for renovation and repair of technology improvements to and other necessary projects related to legislative buildings and facilities. And Madam Chair, Section 27 is the lapse provisions. Sections 28, 29, and 30 are the effective dates. And if people are looking for a total UGF spend for the capital expenditures in this bill, that's not including the operating supplemental or other supplemental items, the UGF spend is $142,492,900. And all funds are $1,387,983,600. And the difference between our capital CS and what the administration proposed to us is $280.5 million. Ours is that lower.
Are there questions from committee members on the structure of the bill? I'll withdraw my objection for adoption of the CS for Senate Finance number 142, version O. Is there further objections to adopting the CS? Seeing and hearing none, the CS for Senate Bill number 142, Finance, is adopted. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. Senator Machicki.
Madam Chair, I asked for a repeat of the difference on UGF, and it was provided to me. It was from the governor's budget. We are $280,487,900 lower. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make some comments. I always like to give credit where credit is due. And first off, I want to thank your staff and your office for providing this document. And Department of Transportation, as we started down this pathway of reining in our spending and operating as efficiently as we could, working with your office some years ago, we started digging into Department of Transportation, Highway Equipment Working Capital Fund. And people remember in the past that used to be $25 million annually. So we started digging into that, going through it line by line, working with SEF, and it's been a pleasure working with them. But I'd like to say that this year's number is $15 million. Last year's number was about the same. We give them a little decrement. But I'd like to say on the record, after working with Department of Transportation, SEF, and going through the methodology why I was suggesting these cuts and extending out the equipment life, this year's list that was provided to our offices had some of the same equipment that we identified 4 years ago to extend the lifespan and save the money and like Bryn Franklin says, use it up and wear it out. So thanks to the Department of Transportation if they're in the room, and I appreciate working with your office on that.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Other comments? Senators, this is a work in process. I want to announce to the general public that we'll take public testimony tomorrow beginning at 1:30, so we'll do everything we can to stay on time. There are multiple pieces of legislation that are requiring senators' works in other parts of the building, so we'll do everything we can to stay to that schedule. We've tried to stick to the schedule that we're putting out, which is why it's coming out 24 or 48 hours beforehand, so that we know whether we have a quorum, whether we can have confidence that we can take the meeting. So this item will be up. Alaska continues to face huge budget deficits. This capital budget is based on withdrawing funds that are in savings. There is not revenue to support some of these appropriations without other actions in the building. And so we just say that we look forward to working with the other body. We know that there are additional wants in all of our communities. There are additional needs across our state that we may hear about tomorrow. We have prioritized public safety in any reapproaches that we take on, as well as deferred maintenance so that we can extend the life of the investments that Alaskans have made that this state has supported over the course of time. But we have prioritized state assets. These are state monies that are coming out to support local communities and the infrastructure that we have deployed across the state to benefit the people of Alaska. So I look forward to hearing the public testimony tomorrow. Again, April 26, 2018, the public hearing in the Senate Finance Committee on the capital budget. Is there anything else on the capital budget before we set this aside? I'll set it aside. We'll do a brief at ease so that we can clear the room. We do have one other piece of business to come before us. The next item on our agenda will be House Bill 316. And if everybody could be back in their seats in 5 minutes by 2:10, we'll be back on the record at 2:10. With that, brief at ease. We're back on the record. It's 11 after 2 on Wednesday, April 25th. The next item before us is House Bill 318. It's an act relating to the release of certain criminal records of conviction and providing for an effective date. I'd like to invite Representative Harriet Drummond and her staff, Patrick Fitzgerald, to the microphone for introduction, and then please present your bill. Welcome to Senate Finance.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Nice to see you once again, and members of Senate Finance. One small correction, it's House Bill 316. I believe you said 318, and I don't know how important that is for the record, but just so you know.
316 it is.
That's right. Thank you, ma'am. I am Representative Harriet Drummond. I represent Spinard in Midtown Anchorage, and this is my staffer, Patrick Fitzgerald. We're here today to present House Bill 316, Confidentiality of Records for Simple Possession of Marijuana. House Bill 316 is intended to clean up court and permanent records for Alaskans who have simple possession of marijuana convictions from pre-legalization in February of 2015. The burden of lifelong criminal records of a crime that's now legal has kept Alaskans from achieving their fullest potential. Mothers, fathers, neighbors, friends who made a mistake in their past or were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time have had to deal with a tall barrier that does have the potential to keep them from a higher quality of life. This is not a pot bill, this is a jobs bill. House Bill 316 is not designed to wipe or give a clean slate to serious offenders. HB 316 will eliminate obstacles that have been keeping Alaskans from gaining employment, advancing in a career, qualifying for certifications, or even having access to loans because of a simple possession charge on their record for a crime that is now legal. Recreational use of marijuana has now been legal for just over 3 years. Alaska has received millions in state revenue generated from cannabis businesses, and small business owners have started to prosper in the cannabis economy. Many Alaskans have benefited from cannabis legalization. Now we have a chance to expand that group by eliminating barriers that are holding Alaskans back and stunting their ability to be productive and contributing members of society. My staff, Patrick Fitzgerald, will be happy to go through the sectional analysis for the committee if that is your wish. Thank you.
Thank you for that overview. Are there questions from committee members on the problem and what we're trying to fix? Mr. Fitzgerald, if you could do a sectional walkthrough for us.
Good afternoon. My name is Patrick Fitzgerald. I am staffed Representative Harry Drummond, and here's the sectional analysis for House Bill 316. Under Section 1, Alaska Statute 12.62.160, stating that if a person applies within the department provided paperwork, the agency may not release the records of a criminal case to the public if the defendant was convicted with possession of a controlled substance Schedule 6A. In that same section, the Schedule 6A is defined under Alaska Statute 71-1171-190. The substance shall be placed in that schedule if it is if it has the lowest degree of danger or probable danger to the person or public. And then subsection under that is marijuana is a Scheduled 6A controlled substance. Also under Section 1, the person must be 21 years old or older at the time of the offense. Also under that section, the person had all of their criminal charges acquitted or dismissed by the prosecuting authority and were not part of a plea deal in another criminal case. Under Section 2, Alaska Statute 22.35040 is amended by adding Alaska Statute 22.35.040. The Alaska court system shall not publish any publicly available website court records of the defendant who was convicted of 6A possession through state or local ordinances as a standalone charge. Also clarifies that marijuana is defined as a Schedule 6A controlled substance. Also includes the person must have been 21 years of age or older, and the person had all other criminal charges acquitted or dismissed by the prosecuting authority and were not part of a plea deal in another case. Section 3 just provides the effective date of 120 days after the bill signing.
Are there questions on the structure of the bill? Overall questions from committee members? Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. We've had a couple hearings on various crime bills as of late as well. Do you know of any other legislation that would change criminal records in the past as a result of Senate Bill 91, subsequent Senate Bill 54, Senate Bill 55, and so forth, as crimes are recategorized or redefined? Are we going back and changing criminal records because of those as well?
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, Senator Von Imhoff, I am not aware of any. I think we're in a unique situation as marijuana is being legalized in many jurisdictions around the country. Other governments are either expunging or cleaning up records in a similar manner. For example, in Vermont, the governor just wholesale expunged the records of, I believe it was about 192 people. And in California, which is probably the most recent state to have legalized the marijuana business, the district attorney in San Francisco alone, I just read the article, he has dismissed approximately 3,000 misdemeanor cases just like that, and he has thousands more. I think this is a result of, first of all, the ballot initiative, the citizen-driven ballot initiative that passed in 2014. The folks who put that together did consider incorporating a feature like this, what this bill proposes, but they determined that it was less likely to pass if it was seen as a crime forgiveness bill rather than an economic development bill, which is really how the marijuana business has turned out to be. Other states have included it in their original bill that legalizes recreational marijuana, and it has worked for them. This is just the way we see it should work here, as thousands of people are now benefiting from legal marijuana and able to possess the same amount that gave these folks the criminal record in the first place. And this is not intended to clean up bad actors. This is simply people who were in the wrong place at the wrong time and weren't thinking and are now in a position where it will follow them around for the rest of their lives while others get to profit from the perfectly now legal sale of marijuana.
Senator Von Imhoff.
You know, without really looking close to see nonviolent possession charge would have to be a nonviolent standalone offense with possession of a Schedule 6A controlled substance. So I just, you mentioned crime forgiveness versus economic development or economic opportunity, and I see your point, and I see that other states are doing that, and I understand that, but I also just wonder, do you think an employer should have that information that a potential employee that they may or may not hire engaged in judgment of having a substance that was illegal at the time, yet use the judgment nonetheless to possess, use whatever it may be of a substance that was illegal? I mean, do you think that that's material in a potential, employment scenario?
I think Senator Von Imhoff,
Representative Drummond,
through the chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Von Imhoff, it's certainly a conversation that an employer and a potential employee should have. This bill does not delete those charges from their record. It simply removes them from court view, which is the publicly available document that anyone can go to and look up any Alaskan's criminal record. In the conversation in the House on final passage of this bill was really interesting. There are a number of people that simply can't stand the fact that everything is listed on court view and anybody can go and look. But that's another conversation. The records will still exist. You can go to the courthouse and see the records. If there is a question on an employment application that asks if you've ever been arrested or convicted of a crime, then the answer definitely needs to be yes, and that applicant needs to have the conversation with their potential employer.
Senator Machicki.
Not to be argumentative, but doesn't Section 1 say that the department may not release records of that criminal case on line 5 and 6 on page 1?
That's DPS, right? Yes. Through the chair, Senator Machicki, that section, the first section refers to the Department of Public Safety, and that's Patrick, if you could explain how that's handled differently from the court view system.
Mr. Fitzgerald.
Patrick Fitzgerald, through the chair to Senator Machicki. From the Department of Public Safety uses a database referred to as APSIN, and that is what from our talks with the department has been the tool to use for records that would be sold to companies or industries looking for those records for a fee, and applicants would apply to the department to not allow those companies to purchase those records, that record being a standalone charge. If there's other, or a standalone conviction of simple possession of marijuana, if there's other charges on those records, the department will release those records to anyone looking to find those records. It's just the simple possession of marijuana that would be withheld from anyone trying to purchase those records from the department.
Senator Machicki, follow up.
I'll wait for, I assume at some point you'll have Ms. Mead up. That would be a good question for her, Madam Chair.
I have several questions for Ms. Mead. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The issue of simple possession, are we talking about a quantity? Does a quantity enter in that, and what is that?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, it's 1 ounce or less. That's the simple possession charge.
Thank you, Representative Drummond.
Madam Chair, I have to
Senator Stevens.
I have to admit that I'm in a time warp here. I was an Army officer, and possession of the smallest amount was a court-martial offense. This is a number of years ago, but people were thrown out, court-martial, thrown out of the Army for any possession at all. I'm just trying to get my head around where we are right now. It's a different world than it was several years ago. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. I have a couple questions. On in reference to the public safety citation versus the court statute, it seems like we're going back in time legalizing something. So is there a time? Are we only sheltering records for possession that are since legalization, or are we sheltering records all the way back in perpetuity? Mr. Fitzgerald.
Patrick Fitzgerald, through the chair. From talks with the Department of Public Safety and the Alaska court system, the database in which the Alaska court system uses is they are able to go back through the entirety of their database and kind of clean those records up. And with the Department of Public Safety, it is an opt-in process, so they're able to look those defendants up or those applicants up as they apply. So that range will depend on all the applicants who fill out the proper paperwork to have their records held.
I'm sorry, I don't understand. Is the answer, it's a yes or no question. It's either yes, that we're going back and asking the courts to remove from court view all possession that they have on it, or not. Is that a yes or is it a no? Under the description in front of us. There's not a maybe, there's a yes or a no.
I think it's no. There is a legislative research report that's part of this record that the court system was able to provide for the years through from 2007 through 2017, a count of cases in which defendants had one or more convictions only under the relevant statute. And that's approximately a little bit over 700 people. Prior to 2007, I don't believe are contained in court view, but I think Ms. Mead is better equipped to answer that question. In addition, in 2012 was the first year that all courts in the state entered case information that ended up in court view. So between 2007 and 2012, there will be cases coming in from, there could be cases that are in other courts around the state that may show up. But right now, we're only aware of roughly 700 people that qualify under the current, who are covered in the current court view records.
Representative Drummond, let me try again. What year did we legalize marijuana as a state?
February 2015.
Representative Drummond, are we removing from court view records prior to that date?
Mm-hmm.
So that was a yes to my question.
Yes, and actually, Madam Chair, the court view shows 17 convictions in 2015, 6 in 2016, and 2 in 2017. So they dribbled off. There were hundreds prior to the date of legalization. So the total number of cases that we're really asking court view to screen from public view are roughly 700.
Cases when it was illegal?
Yes, ma'am.
Other questions from committee members?
Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens.
Just a very quick question. This could include multiple arrests, right?
More than one arrest, through the chair, Senator Stevens, you mean more than one arrest for possession of an ounce or less of marijuana? It could, but this is simply to make confidential the or screen from public view through court view simple marijuana possessions. If that simple marijuana arrest was in addition to some other crime, maybe some more serious drug, gun play that was completely inappropriate, that kind of stuff is not going to be cleared from the record, and it will keep the marijuana record that was made at the same time.
Thank you.
Other questions from committee members? Thank you for introducing your bill.
Thank you for hearing it, Madam Chair.
What I'd like to do with the Senate support is, the Senate Finance, is go to the public testimony so that we can get that on the record for those that are waiting, and then we'll bring Ms. Mead up as well as other departments to ask other questions to verify our understanding of what the bill before us does. I'd like to open the public hearing on the CS for House Bill 316, Finance as amended. It's version T.A. It's an act relating to the release of certain records of convictions and providing for an effective date. The first person waiting to testify off net is Casey Reynolds. Mr. Reynolds, your name for the record, affiliation, and then please proceed with your testimony. Mr. Reynolds, are you available online?
Can you hear me?
Try again, Mr. Reynolds.
Can you hear me?
We're trying to turn up our volume. One second. If you could restate your name and your affiliation.
My name is Casey Reynolds. I'm the communications director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska, the ACLU. Can you hear me fine now?
We can, Casey. Thank you for calling in to Senate Finance.
Sure. We are supporting HB 316, and we have two primary concerns. The first is a racial disparity in marijuana convictions. Both nationally and here in Alaska, there's a huge disparity between the enforcement of marijuana-related laws along racial grounds, even though whites and minority folks tend to use marijuana at the same rates. Here in Alaska, when we compare census data to arrest data, you can see that African Americans, even though they make up 3.3% of the state population, they used to make up 7% of the arrests, and Alaska Natives and American Indians make up 14.8% of the population, but made up 23.5% of the arrests. So there was clearly a racial disparity, and when Alaska decided to make marijuana legal, they went a long way towards remedying some of that racial disparity in the Alaska criminal justice system. And we see HB 316 as simply the completion of that effort and doing away with the stigma that went along with that activity that Alaskans have now decided should be legal. Our second concern is along privacy grounds. As many of you know, the ACLU is deeply concerned with what information the government collects and distributes about its citizens. And here in Alaska, we have a privacy provision, and at the heart of that provision in the state constitution, we believe, is the fact that the state shouldn't be collecting or distributing information on its citizens unless it has a compelling public purpose. Well, in this case, there was clearly a compelling public purpose to collect the information. It was criminal activity at the time. But we believe that that public purpose, that compelling reason to distribute that information to the public, went away when Alaska decided that instead of being a legal activity, this should be a legal and even tax-paying activity. And so we don't believe that there still is any compelling public purpose for the government to be telling anybody what its citizens were doing related to this activity that's now legal. And I think that pretty well completes our testimony. Thank you.
Are there questions from committee members? Mr. Reynolds, thank you for calling in and testifying on House Bill 316. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 316, either here in Juneau, online, or off-net? Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing is closed. Ms. Mead, could you join us at the microphone? Do we have a representative from public safety available to testify? Allison, would you like to join us at the microphone? Ms. Mead, I'm going to go sideways first. We had a bill in front of us. It may have been last session. It could have been the session before, where Alaskans are being treated differently than out-of-state records, and I'm grasping on remembering what that was. We were trying to come into compliance with VAWA for sexual assault reports. Are you recalling the – and I'm wondering, could you just give me an update on that? It had to do with court view. It had to do with public disclosure, and somehow folks coming from out of state are being treated, in my opinion, factually very differently than those in the state, and I'd like to be reminded of the specific instance.
Through the chair, for the record, this is Nancy Mead, general counsel for the Alaska court system. That is an issue that I actually have not looked at for about a year. I can try to remember that the issue had to do with domestic violence protective orders. The court system does publish on court view petitions for domestic violence protective orders unless they are denied basically right away by the judge on a finding that there's either not a domestic relationship or there was not enough evidence to even support an ex parte order. So generally we do post domestic violence protective orders. And last year there was the thinking that perhaps the court system should not be, because the Federal Violence Against Women's Act says that when foreign DV protective orders are filed in this state, and by foreign I just mean an order issued by another state, for example, California, the federal VAWA, Violence Against Women Act, says that a court shall not publish that information. The court interprets VAWA literally, and so we therefore do not publish anything about a protective order that's issued in another jurisdiction. We have interpreted that to apply only to those protective orders from other jurisdictions, so we do publish things about in-state domestic violence protective orders. We have not changed that practice since last year.
Ms. Mead, as I recall, that was still not consistent with the federal order in its entirety, and that if you weren't convicted So the issue, as I remember the conversation about Alaskans and protective orders, is the point that sometimes protective orders are used to provide advantage in the court system for whatever party is requesting the court order. That is my perspective. It may not be accurate, but we've seen it used, at least in some instances, with folks who might be going through a child custody battle to go down and get a protective order against one parent or the other. And so I had the issue. The bill was passed without addressing that, and I'm just wondering what we're doing to create equity in protective orders because a judge hasn't found by evidence that there is an actual threat. There's a threat is presented, and they issue those orders.
To the chair, I think what you're getting at is because we publish every protective order, unless it's denied right away, there may be some people whose name appears on court view when factually or truthfully that person did not commit an act of domestic violence. The court system has come to the conclusion, as far as the court system is willing to go, the Supreme Court threw a rule that if the petition makes it through the first hearing, so there was some judicial determination that there's something going on here, we keep it on court view. If, on the other hand, at that very first hearing, the judicial officer decides, no, basically this should not even have been filed, then we don't publish those on court view. And that is the same situation as we had last year. The legislature may or could instruct the court otherwise to not post anything about domestic violence protective orders. There are two sides to that policy call. Some people want the names up there, and some people do not. So without further direction from the legislature, I think that is probably as far as the court's going to go on that issue.
Ms. Mead, thank you for helping me remember those particular court view changes. This conversation just piqued my interest in where we were at on that, because I knew that we did actually address the out-of-state members through statutory action last year. With that, Ms. Mead, could you please give us the court's comments on what is being proposed in House Bill 316, and if there is additional clarification based on the answers that we received from the sponsor, please provide those to the committee now.
To the chair, Section 2 of the bill is the one that concerns the court system. Section 1 is under Title 12, and that is when people ask for a criminal background check on an individual, and Department of Public Safety can best describe what's going on in Section 1. Section 2 only deals with court view, which, of course, is not the state's official criminal database. APSIN through DPS is. Still, people look at court view, as we know, to get information on people and draw conclusions as they might. So what Section 2 says is that the court system must remove from court view all old convictions for possession of under an ounce of marijuana by somebody over 21 unless it was part of a plea bargain in another case, is that line 11 through 14. So under this, we would remove, as the sponsor said, the 700 cases we were able to identify quickly. We just went back to 2007 initially to give a ballpark idea of how many of these cases we had. We do have cases on court view going back further than that. And under the wording of this, since we may not publish any of these records, we will, should this pass, go back and remove any additional. I would expect there could be a couple hundred more. And so we were able to identify the cases with these convictions. We can do that without fiscal impact if this bill should change, because it's something that we can do with a computer script or something.
Ms. Mead, Senator Von Imhoff, I think you asked the question, and I'm trying to, along these lines, that wasn't me. Going back in time, I know that I asked how many cases would be affected. Maybe it was Senator Bishop. If some, I'm just going to go around the table. Senator Stevens, if there are multiple convictions of 1 ounce or less, those are still going to be removed, and can you give the committee any understanding of the 700 to 1,000 cases that might be removed from view? How many of them are there because of multiple interactions with law enforcement and otherwise?
To the chair, it is true that under the wording of this bill, if somebody has a case in 2007 and another case in 2009 and another in 2014 for this same conduct, possession of under an ounce of marijuana, with the wording of this bill, we would remove each of those. I think what the sponsor may have been describing, so yes, it would cover multiple. I think what the sponsor was perhaps getting at with a related question was, if you're charged with two offenses in the same case, which is common to be charged with several charges in one case. What this bill, though, says is that you have to be, the only ones we're going to remove is if they end up with only the marijuana conviction. So if they end up, after the course of the criminal proceeding, with two convictions, one for, as the sponsor used as an example, a C felony gun possession or something, plus marijuana, we would leave that case on court view because they didn't have all their other criminal charges convicted or acquitted. So if they're conjoined in the same place, a case, and they're convicted of more than one thing, we'd leave it up. The ones we're taking down as if this is the only conviction in that case.
Senator Stevens, did you have a follow-up on that?
And I think I understand that, Madam Chair, so that if there is a multiple issue in a case, that would remain in court for you. The only ones taken out would be if there was simply a possession of less than an ounce.
And through the chair, Senator Stevens, yes, as long as that was the only conviction. They could have been charged with several things. Everything else was dismissed, and all they end up with is a marijuana conviction. We will take that off the court view under this wording.
Thank you.
So we've had quite a bit of testimony on criminal justice reform, and one of the issues that we have already went back and changed is under this small we changed it under small petty theft. But one of the things we didn't consider is multiple infractions of the same item and sort of totaling the items together. I think it was a shoplifting provision, as I'm recalling. And so we had quite a bit of criminal mischief happening by just stealing small amounts and impacting many different owners over those small takes, per se. And so this is why I think that you see some hypersensitivity to one time and done as far as backtracking through time, and I'm just wondering whether we should consider multiple convictions, or if a person is always showing up with only an ounce, are they involved in other activities that we just can't convict them for, that they're always in the wrong place at the wrong time with 1 ounce or less in possession? Because Alaska had legalized marijuana before the initiative passed. The initiative was commercialization of marijuana and taxation of that commercialization. It was not legalization as many people thought it was. My words, my view. Ms. Mead.
To the chair, if you're saying that this could be changed to say that if you have more than one, then the court system will not remove it, that's your policy call, and we could react to that as well. And I'm thinking we could react to that as well. I don't know if we would have to compare names, but that would be your policy call and up to
you. Sounds like 1,000 names on an Excel spreadsheet, but sometimes I know it's more complicated than that. Senator Machicki.
Yeah, Madam Chair, legalization was not legal, or possession was not legal other than in the privacy of your own home due to the Raven case, up to 4 ounces. And these would have been people outside of their home, likely, of 1 ounce or less, which was not legal until the initiative. But the initiative also continued to make it illegal to consume publicly. And I wonder how many were charged with simple possession that may have been, I mean, it's more complicated than that. I don't know, it has to be a big deal. I'm just saying it was a one time, the officer just decided to charge with possession of 1 ounce or less, but that person was publicly consuming it would still be illegal today for them to consume publicly. Is that correct, Ms. Mead?
Through the chair to Senator Michicki, yes, I believe that the public consumption, though, today, I'm almost certain is not a crime per se. It's a violation, and the person simply receives a citation, and I think we have a bail schedule. It's a bail schedule offense.
Different question, Madam Chair.
Senator Michicki.
I asked earlier, and I'm not sure that we got this right on the record, but the Section 1, lines 4, 5, and 6 on page 1, it looks to me that if I'm an employer doing a somewhat of a background check on a potential employee, that the department could no longer release. So we're not just talking about court view. This seems to say that those records would not be released. Is that correct?
Through the chair to Senator Michicki, that's mostly correct. Section 2 says it's not on court view, and as the sponsor said, a person could come to the courthouse and ask for these records. But Section 1 does have to do with a real criminal background check, and it says that the Department of Public Safety, which is where you go for your real background checks, could not release these records. But it's if the person affected walks in and initiates the process. So at DPS, it's an opt-in process. With the court, we're just removing them wholesale upon the effective date. With DPS, they'll have to have a system for folks to walk in and ask that their name be removed from absent for those criminal background checks.
Senator Michicki, followed by Senator Bishop.
I don't know if that necessarily answered my question. If I'm an employer and I have an applicant that is a potential employee and this passes, would I still learn about their prior convictions of possession of 1 ounce of marijuana or less by going to either the courthouse or the Department of Public Safety, or will those records essentially be expunged and out of the view of a potential employer?
Through the chair to Senator Michicki, an employer could come to the courthouse and see if there were records on any potential employee by going to the special kiosk that has more information than public court view has on it. So that would be available. That's the first part of your question. Secondly, if the person pays their fee to APSIN, which, you know, big employers do, to the Department of Public Safety for a true criminal background check, because, again, the court records aren't a true criminal background check, so companies go to DPS, they would not get this if the person had opted into the program with DPS. But if the person with their 2008 conviction doesn't care, maybe they have other criminal convictions, or maybe they just don't bother, APSIN is not going to clear their name automatically.
Senator Michicki?
That answers my question, Madam Chair.
Senator Bishop?
I was going to help with that scenario, but I still want to say it out loud. So I apply. I have been convicted 2000.
You're giving us a hypothetical?
Hypothetical. Yeah, I filled out one of them statements when I was Commissioner of Labor, so I passed that one, so I'm still good. So I get convicted in 2008 of 1 ounce or less. Okay, so I've seen the error of my ways, and I've went to treatment. I went through a program, and I'm proud of myself now. I'm clean. I want to go to work, but I can't go because this is a barrier on my employment record with this particular, maybe I want to be a state trooper. So now I go in, if this law is passed as written, I go into my employer and they say, well, have you ever used? And I said, yep, I did. It was an ounce or less. But I will walk down with you to the courthouse or to the public safety, and I can sign a document. Can I sign a piece of paper that would allow my employer to look at my conviction record just to prove what I said? Is that still possible under this, if this bill was to pass as written?
Through the chair to Senator Bishop, that is probably a question for the Department of Public Safety, who I know is right here ready to answer that. I could sense
Allison, if you could identify yourself for the record.
For the record, this is Allison Hanzawa. I am a special assistant to the Commissioner for Department of Public Safety, through the chair, Senator Bishop. I'll do my best to answer your question. It depends on, first of all, which sort of job or which sort of background check is being run, whether this information would be available after somebody opted in. So as Ms. Mead said, if somebody doesn't opt in, then it's available as it normally is. For your example, for law enforcement employment, for example, that's criminal justice activity. That this is not an expungement of this conviction. Mm-hmm. That would still be in the record. It would still be available for criminal justice activity for any of the employers or licensing organizations listed under 1262-400. It's still in there. This would just apply to that narrow section of 1262-160 for the any person background check, which is a general employment background check.
Senator Bishop?
Thank you. I'm good.
Allison, would the federal government, if we... if there's an opt-in provision that's activated on a criminal history, would a federal inquiry still get it from our system, or since we've blocked it out or redacted it, would it now be unavailable to federal distribution?
To the chair, it would still be in the federal system. We're not removing anything from the federal system or shielding it from the federal system. This would just be for the state purposes under that narrow section of the statute.
Could you tell me, from public safety's perspective, the issue of going backwards in time? The initiative was not retroactive. The initiative. It happened. I did not vote for it. I do think it's contributing to crime in the Anchorage area. Tell me how going back in time is the right thing to do for public safety.
To the chair, the Department of Public Safety isn't taking a position on the public policy aspect of that. Our concern has been that we're able to implement it if you do choose to pass this law, and that it doesn't impact the integrity of the criminal justice records that we keep.
Can you tell me if someone is carrying over an ounce, or I guess it's under an ounce. If someone's carrying under an ounce and we're finding it now, is there a likelihood that they're driving impaired? Or is there no relationship between carrying in public, because we're saying this happened in public, not in private, because in private you could have 4 ounces under Raven, at least that's what I thought I heard. So we're in public, we have under an ounce. Is it likely that they're using, or are they just carrying it somewhere?
I apologize. I don't have any statistical information about that. I think that if there was another crime being charged at the time, in addition to possession, like driving under the influence, for example, that wouldn't qualify under the language here.
Senator Majicki.
It's a tough one because, if there's a single conviction of carrying under an ounce years ago, it probably shouldn't be a barrier to employment. But just another hypothetical, because we're having some discussions about that. But I had at least one speeding ticket on the Sterling Highway when the speed limit was 55. And now it's been increased to 65. So was I not speeding anymore? I mean, isn't that a similar discussion?
Through the chair, Senator Majicki. Obviously, this is a policy call for the committee to make. That we're not taking a position on that, or whether this should be extended to other things in the law that have changed.
Thank you, Ms. Hanzawa. Senator Bishop.
So, in Senator Machicki's scenario of 55 on the Sterling Highway, and the law went to 65. I think if he does, and within 10 years, if he's got a good driving record, it automatically comes off. Isn't that correct?
Through through the chair, Senator Bishop. I don't actually know that.
Because I can tell you, I lost my driver's license when I was 17 years old for a whole bunch of speeding tickets. And I lost it for 30 days. And then 30 days later, it was magic. I got it back. And I had a clean driving record. But anyway, I thought it was 10 years and your record was expunged on speeding tickets.
Well, let's not go into bankruptcy court and other things. We do have a bill in front of us that is trying to, as the sponsor said, allow people to go to work and not have a record held against them based on an initiative that's passed that has legalized marijuana in our state. Whether I like or dislike that particular law, it's on the books. I'm happy to measure it against what we have before us. The issue that I have before us is that we're going back in time and undoing, we're undoing actions or going to cover up actions that were illegal and were a violation of state law during that time. So it is consistent with Senator Michicki's scenario that was I speeding or wasn't I speeding if we increase the speed limit. So that's where I'm at right now. I'm happy to discuss it with the sponsor to see if there's language or the committee to see what the committee has to say about these important issues. I would like to put on the record that amendments or concerns are due to my office by Thursday at 5 p.m. So please, if you have concerns or ideas for conversations around the bill before us, please let me know. Senator Von Imhoff. Senator Bishop, can we cover the fiscal note? Other questions for public safety or the courts? Thank you for being available and taking no position.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are you ready?
We are ready.
Okay. Fiscal note number one, Department of Judiciary. Appropriation is Alaska Court System. Allocations to Trial Courts, OMB, component number 768. Cost is zero. The court system can remove these cases from the public version of court view and can disallow public access to the paper files without physical impact. Doing so will require some staff time for administrators to revise the court view parameters and electronically designate the files as confidential, but we are able to absorb the task in the normal course of business. Therefore, zero fiscal note. Number two is Department of Public Safety, Statewide Support, Criminal Justice Information System. OMB component is 3200. $28,000 in fiscal year 19. The out years are zero. The analysis here says there are 1,939 records in the APSIN for standalone convictions, applicable under this bill. Should the bill pass, Department of Public Safety staff would research and redact the applicable records under the request. DPS does not anticipate this to result in a significant increase in the workload for the program staff. However, to ensure that the redacted records are not inadvertently released, APSIN would need additional element of programming to block the identified criminal history. This would require 200 hours of programmer time at $140 an hour, resulting in a total cost of $28,000.
Are there questions on the fiscal note? Ms. Anzawa, would we? Allison. It's a request. Can you check with corrections, or I'll have my staff check with corrections to see if this bill would impact anything that is currently in process for completion, or whether in corrections, whether this kind of application or change would affect any of that. I don't see corrections listed in here. I'm just wondering if I believe we were told there were no cases of convictions for just possession of 1 ounce or under in the correction system. I just want to confirm that we don't have anyone incarcerated that we're going to start shielding for other reasons for. And I believe that we were told the answer to that was no, there was no one convicted or in our prisons under these sets of circumstances. I just want to confirm that. So I'll have my staff do that, but I'll ask you again, I'm sure.
Fifth Chair, okay. I will check with DOC.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Fitzgerald, I was going to allow the representative back at the table if she wanted to provide his comments on, I know I just saw her leave. I just couldn't get to her before she got out of the room. Would you like to provide the committee any additional comments on the concerns that were raised at the Finance Committee table today?
Patrick Fitzgerald through the chair to the Senate Finance Committee. I'd just like to go on record and say if there are any questions or concerns that are brought up in between this hearing and the next, I'd be happy to answer them for you.
Mr. Fitzgerald, the issue, one of the issues is going retroactively back into files when possession was illegal, removing those from the court view system. So at least that's my concern. So if you have a response now or if you want to draft one for us for our consideration on why we should do that, that would be helpful.
Patrick Fitzgerald, through the chair, I'd be happy to put something in writing and get back to you.
Certainly. In our fiscal note, it's showing 1,900 folks that would be affected by the bill before us. Any questions for Mr. Fitzgerald? Amendments are due tomorrow by 5 o'clock. Or concerns so that I know that we need to work with drafting. Thank you, Mr. Fitzgerald. With that, we'll set aside House Bill 316. We have been joined by Captain Dan Loudon from Alaska State Troopers. If I could direct your attention back to the document for a moment. Captain Loudon, did you want to comment on the bill before us?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. They were unmuting me, and I missed your question.
I saw that you were just joining us online, and I was wondering if you had comments for considerations for the Senate Finance Committee on House Bill 316.
Ma'am, I was here to throw a lifeline for Ms. Hanzella.
She is smiling, and I'm assured very thankful for your participation. I asked her whether we had anyone incarcerated in prison for this type of an offense. I believe we'll have to check with the Department of Corrections, but if you could provide any additional comments regarding that, that would be helpful.
No, ma'am. I'd either have to check with Corrections or with our admin or statewide services who run absent to be able to see if there was anybody that's incarcerated.
Thank you, Captain Loudon. The other question was, how does public safety feel about going retroactively back and shielding from the general public's eye through court view convictions?
Madam Chair, I think Ms. Hanzawa expressed that we're trying to be very neutral on this. I've heard many folks discuss this issue, and I think that's part of the crux of the matter is whether or not you are in fact expunging or changing someone's record. The view seems to be that this is legal now, so the fact that someone did it prior to the legalization date should be expunged from the record, and other folks who view things such as this as it was illegal at the time and a person who did something at the time knowing it was illegal probably should still have that on their record. I think that's the question that folks are trying to answer here.
Captain Loudon, I appreciate those comments. Senator Machicki?
Well, I think it was clarified to us that it remains on their record. It doesn't, nothing gets expunged. It's whether or not it's visible to the public. You could still go to the courthouse and get the detailed criminal record from these cases. It's just whether or not it's easily researchable on court view or just simply by going to the Department of Public Safety.
Senator Machicki, that is what we heard today, and I believe that is accurate. The court system is nodding their head in an affirmative. which I guess she's not supposed to do, as far as nodding. I believe we've had an acknowledgement that it is has been accurately reflected to us today that it is not expunged. It becomes less attainable in the sense that those are searching for housing or landlords would not know or not see if there was a possession which may be of interest to some landlords. Insurance agencies, depending on the information that they buy regarding the risk factors associated with any individual, would not be able to see past possession charges without physically going to our court system to check. So there's a balance between it preventing folks, as the sponsor has suggested, prevents folks from employment opportunities that may be something from their past, or housing opportunities if landlords see that information and choose to consider that in a negative way and then not rent to a particular individual. So that it cuts both ways. Captain Loudon, thank you so much for calling in. We know that you're busy. Thank you for your service to the people of Alaska as well as all those who testified today. Let's set aside House Bill 316. Amendments are due tomorrow or concerns at 5 p.m. Thursday. On tomorrow morning's agenda, we have HB 135, school construction grants, HB 150, pay allowances and benefits for militia members, and HB 233, extension of the education tax credits. If we have other bills that are prepared to go, if we've gotten CSs or other issues resolved, we'll bring those forward for those that are following us. And again, in the afternoon, we have the capital budget before us for public testimony beginning at 1:30. With that, thank you, Senators. We're adjourned.